Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week is the fact that the President of the United States has called the media the enemy of the American people. He doesn't like news he hears when it's contrary to what he wants us, the American people, to think. But contrary to the President's wishes, the Washington Post broke the news story that Attorney General Jeff Sessions failed to disclose, under oath, contact he had had with the Russians. In fact, as a senator and campaigner for Donald Trump, he did speak with the Russian ambassador to the United States. Under oath, he told Senator Al Franken that he had had no contact. I believe he lied. I think he should resign. We'll see what happens. But before that story broke, some were saying President Trump had managed to sound, at least in style, somewhat presidential in his address on Tuesday night to a joint session of Congress.
Tonight, as we mark the conclusion of our celebration of Black History Month, we are reminded of our nation's path toward civil rights and the work that still remains to be done.
I spoke with two reporters this week, Maggie Haberman of the New York Times and Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post, about what the president said and what it means. And in light of the attacks President Trump has leveled against the media, I wanted to know how, if at all, they had changed their approach to their jobs.
Trump does not hate the media. Trump needs the media. It's his oxygen. It always has been. I covered him at tabloids in New York City for a long time. But he is dabbling in something very dangerous.
We haven't seen anything quite like this ever before. People call this Nixonian in some respects. I would argue it's different than Nixonian because President Nixon never really said anything quite like President Trump has said in recent days.
So let's hear first from Maggie Haberman of the New York Times. Maggie, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
You know, the president has had a rough few weeks. Did his address to Congress earlier this week signal a new approach?
I think it's very dangerous to have any kind of predictive value on and carryover from one Donald Trump event or speech to another. I think that it certainly exceeded expectations, which, as we know, have been set pretty low for him by now, and he has set them low himself with a chaotic first month in office. I think that the tone was very well received. I think the pitch was very well received. But remember, it was a speech that, number one, was very low on specifics on all kinds of issues. He did not talk about in any depth repealing Obamacare. He did not talk in any depth about how he's going to pay for this very long laundry list of items that he has. He did practice for this speech, and he practiced more than I have seen him, and I've been covering his campaign since it began.
How do you know that?
Just from talking to people who were involved. But
all right.
He did practice.
He
did take an ownership of this speech that was different than ones before. It was less someone else's voice and words that he was reading. This one did sound more like him.
It's interesting because we had a comment from Twitter that said, I could hear the difference between topics important to Trump and those that were written for him.
I think that is definitely true. But I think that he was more hands-on in trying to make it as seamless as possible so you couldn't see the stitching quite so pronouncedly as you have in some of his other speeches. He cares about immigration. He does, but he doesn't exactly know what he thinks on immigration. We've heard him do the broad top line of we need borders and we need to control our borders, but he doesn't really get into details. And a lot of the devil is going to be in the details.
Of course.
On that, on Obamacare, on any number of topics. I really think there's a danger in describing the speech earlier this week as a reset, which, you know, the morning after the speech, I saw it called, you know, anything from a reset to, you know, the night he became president to, you know, this means a new era. And Donald Trump has been having a series of alleged pivots for the last 2 years, and they really never last. It doesn't mean that he didn't win. He did win, but it's dangerous to say.
What about the Affordable Care Act? You wrote that the day before he gave the speech, there was some indication he might well include some details.
That had been our indication, and then they basically pulled back and decided not to. They are still wrestling with, and I think we may see something as early as next week, wrestling with exactly how to do this, how close they want the president to be to being the messenger on this, him versus, say, someone else from the administration. They are not in sync yet with congressional Republicans. They are trying to get there, and they may get there by next week.
What are the differences?
I think that I'm going to mess this up, so I don't want to trip on myself. But I think that there's just a difference in terms of specifically what the president would like to see done with Medicaid and what members of Congress would like to see done. And that's a huge point. You get rid of Obamacare and you're impacting other so-called entitlement programs that the president has said he wants to maintain.
So, in other words, the campaign rally of throw out Obamacare is no longer in the mix.
They're going to describe it as in the mix, for lack of a better way of putting it. But I think that what you see actually happening will not look like a wholesale tossing of it. You had that line from the president earlier this week, which was sort of just a painful step in a pothole for him, where he said nobody understood how complex health care could be.
And replace Obamacare and get states the flexibility that they need to make the end result really, really good for them. Very complicated issue. It's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that health care could be so complicated.
And that's, of course, not true. He didn't understand how complex it could be. There was a Politico montage video of clips of President Obama talking about how complicated health care is and why this is so hard during the course of his own 2 terms. And I think that President Trump is, to be fair to him, he's a businessman. He's never held office in his life. So this is all a huge learning curve for him.
Can he really rise above the differences between not only Republicans and Democrats, but Republicans themselves?
Do you mean specifically on Obamacare or
on
anything?
All the issues he's got facing him.
It's funny. It's a great question. And it's funny because he really is, if you look at how he grew up and sort of the arc of his political adulthood in New York City, you know, the mayor when I was a child was Mayor Ed Koch. And he is the person who I think Trump is most like in a lot of ways. There is some Rudy Giuliani mayoral years in there, too. But essentially, Trump's governing philosophy is not that different from Ed Koch, who became pretty conservative as he got older and was also a big government guy. I mean, if you hear Trump talk about the infrastructure bill, that sounds very familiar to me, to 1980s New York. I don't know that he's going to be able to rise above it because and unite everybody. He is indeed, as you say, finding himself at odds with his own party a lot.
There was, at least for me, something of a surprise that when he began his speech, he talked about anti-Semitism. He came out very strongly against that.
Recent threats targeting Jewish community centers and vandalism of Jewish cemeteries, as well as last week's shooting in Kansas City, remind us that while we may be a nation divided on policies, we are a country that stands united in condemning hate and evil in all of its very ugly forms.
And it was interesting because just before that speech, he had apparently made some comments to the Pennsylvania Attorney General. And he said something like the reverse having been responsible.
He was essentially, as I understand it from the reports of that meeting with the state attorneys general, He described the threats, the bomb threats, and there have been many on Jewish community centers and schools, as something of a false flag operation by his political opponents, which is a really shocking thing to say. It is a frame of conspiracy theory, not just in certain hard right-wing blogosphere areas, but also on some white supremacist sites. That's a very startling thing to say. He didn't say it publicly. He went the furthest he has gone in terms of condemning those threats and also talked about the shootings of two Indian men in Kansas City for the first time. He got praised for that. This is, I think, to most observers, the bare minimum of what a president could do in terms of the type of ugliness that we're seeing, both in that attack on the two Indian men and with the Jewish community centers.
And with the overturning of cemeteries.
That's right, yes. And we're now on the second one. There was St. Louis and then there was Philadelphia.
Right.
You saw those images of Mike Pence last week out there tilling the soil at that cemetery in St. Louis. We have heard very little from a president who is extremely quick to condemn all kinds of people, usually if they're attacking him in his mind. But
in effect, what he was doing in those comments to the attorney general was, again, attacking what he believed were his opponents.
What he believed were his opponents, and you struck on what is the key here in terms of understanding Trump, which is that everything is a lens inward to him. That's how he sees it. It is all reflected back on him. He has real trouble doing what is a staple of all presidents, was certainly a staple of Bill Clinton. It was less so of Obama, just because Obama sort of struggled with this in terms of connecting with other people. But Trump has often been criticized as being devoid of empathy. And I think devoid is a pretty strong term, but I would say that he certainly has trouble putting himself in someone else's shoes just sort of on a routine basis. That can be very, very stifling as a president.
In the audience the other night was the wife of the slain soldier who died in Yemen. And earlier in the week, President Trump blamed that on the generals.
Mm-hmm. In fact, earlier that day of the speech, or maybe in an interview that aired earlier that day on Fox News, his comments where it was they lost Ryan is what he said of the generals and the slain SEAL. It was a very striking moment in the speech when there was a sustained applause for this widow who was overcome
with grief. The widow of U.S. Navy Special Operator, Senior Chief William Ryan Owens. Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation.
Ivanka Trump, the president's eldest daughter, was standing next to the widow. And I was struck because she didn't really reach out to comfort her or any. And I think, again, this is sort of new to the Trump family on how you interact with people.
How you express empathy.
Yes. And I think that there's a reserved quality to them, which you don't really associate with Trump when you think about him off the cuff. You don't think of him as reserved. But his children certainly have more of that. It was a touching moment, but it was also, I think, a complicated moment because of what you just pointed to, the criticism that he had sort of leveled, however subdued, in suggesting that it was not his fault as the commander-in-chief of the military, but the generals. They lost. This was their mission. They lost him. That's not something we're used to hearing from a U.S. president. Usually it's I or we, and assuming and understanding the role that they play.
Of responsibility.
Exactly. And this was sort of offloading responsibility. There was a weird moment in what you were talking about with the widow in the crowd where there was this very sustained applause. And Trump commented on it, and the president said something to the effect of, you know, that broke a record, meaning in terms of the applause. And I think that he then said something about how the dead SEAL was looking down so happy.
And Ryan is looking down right now, you know that, and he's very happy because I think he just broke a record.
He really struggles with hitting the appropriate notes sometimes, and some of this is sort of, I've covered other businessmen who became politicians, and they do have they tend to say things that would politically strike you as kind of strange. But on this one, this is how Trump measures everything, is sort of the applause-o-meter, except in that moment, this was not a positive. And it was an otherwise, as I said, very moving moment. But the criticism that I heard afterwards this week was that he was essentially deflecting criticism of this mission by reaching for the memory of the man who died there. And that's complicated.
Maggie, who's running the show at the White House these days?
I hate difficult questions. It depends on the day. Some moments it seems to depend on the hour. The person with unsurpassed influence, other than the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is Stephen Bannon, the chief strategist. His fingerprints are on almost everything that's grand scale. And he's one of the only people around Trump in that circle who has an actual philosophy. If not an ideology, he does have a sort of a worldview and what he believes. And some of that is very controversial, but he does actually have a measure and a thought on how he thinks things should go. Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, is serving as one of the least familiar types of chief of staff that we've seen in the White House in some time. I think that when you think of a White House chief of staff, you tend to think of somebody who's either sort of a bullish style operative like a Rahm Emanuel, or someone of stature like a Leon Panetta or a James Baker. Priebus is a sort of local political operative. He was once skewered by John Weaver, the Republican political strategist, as a Kenosha political operative.
What does that mean?
Meaning that he's small time. That was the criticism. And it's a thankless job if you are Reince Priebus. Trump does not understand what a White House chief of staff does. And he clearly thinks of it as some kind of a paper-pushing job. You know, this is somebody who gets me this memo, gets me that, fetch. And so he has empowered somebody who does not look like somebody of stature and who does not sort of intimidate. And Trump is not interested in a traditional gatekeeper role, which is what chiefs of staff have played. Priebus has really been struggling to wrangle various pieces.
The issue of the press and how it has covered Donald Trump, he has repeated again and again that the operations at the White House are running very smoothly. The whole operation is smooth, and yet reporters like yourself have claimed it's a White House in chaos, which indeed the White House has said. He's called fake news.
So Trump is a salesman. And he has been a salesman for many, many decades, even when he was selling real estate. I mean, when he was selling real estate, he was less of a showman about it initially, but there has always been a selling quality. He is always selling someone, whether it's a voter, whether it's the press. That is always what this is about. Trump used to tell people that The Apprentice was the number one show in its time slot, even though it wasn't. He would claim that he had more properties than he did. He is very, very good at kind of rounding up by a certain percentage whatever the issue is for himself. And so listening to him describe things as he called it a well-oiled machine is not surprising. It doesn't make it true. And so the true news is that the White House is struggling, as all White Houses do, and you know this much better than I do, in the early stages to find its footing. I mean, this one in some ways reminds me the most in terms of recent history of the early days of the Bill Clinton presidency of, you know, outsider comes to Washington, is looked down upon by a certain group of D.C. elites, brings along personal loyalists. You know, it was Matt McClarty, I think, was Bill Clinton's version of this. A person who serves as both the comms director and the press secretary gets bumped after 5 months in some way, which was Stephanopoulos, and a president who speaks by phone late at night to a lot of people outside the White House.
Yes.
And Bill Clinton did that, and Donald Trump does that. That feels familiar. But the rest of this feels like accelerated intensity. They are having trouble filling a lot of these jobs with people who they want. And then there are a ton of people who don't want to work there. So
and
it's a bad combo.
Maggie, you mentioned true news versus, if we can put it this way, alternative facts. How will you, as a journalist, well, let me put this another way. The news media is totally under attack by the White House and people around the country who believe that the news media is anti-Trump and delivering fake news and providing them with alternative facts. How can you, as a journalist, counter that impression?
It's an excellent question that I still don't have a precise answer to. But in the immediate sense, I think that there are a couple of things that I need to do, that the media in general needs to do. I think we would all be served well to stay off Twitter more, honestly. I think we are all talking to each other. I think there's a bit of a group hysteria around Trump that is not helping anyone see clearly. I think that there are enormous implications, real world implications of what he is doing with this attack on the press in terms of enemy of the people, which, as my colleague Alex Burns pointed out, it took decades of, you know, hearing secret tapes from Nixon to hear him say that. And Trump just says it all outside. And his supporters don't understand that this is a game, a lot of them, for him. Trump does not hate the media. Trump needs the media. It's his oxygen. It always has been. I covered him at tabloids in New York City for a long time. But he is dabbling in something very dangerous. So what we have to do is be extra careful about facts. We have to make sure that everything is demonstrable about facts. And we have to, I think, start in our stories and in our narrations, make clearer as we go that not just say Sean Spicer declined requests for comment or didn't respond. Sean Spicer did not respond to 7 emails sent over the course of the last 3 days. It has to be explained what we're talking about in a way that we're not used to doing in news stories. And I think those are sort of incremental steps, but they're important ones.
Maggie Haberman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Good to talk with you.
You too.
Let's take a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Now, let's hear from Washington Post reporter Ed O'Keefe. Ed, the president's speech the other night before a joint session of Congress seemed to have enough in it to attempt to bridge divides between the administration and congressional leaders. How far do you think he went?
In talking to Democrats since the speech, I don't think he necessarily went far enough. Words is one thing, action is another. When the shoe was on the other foot, Republicans would have responded that way to President Obama, and now Democrats are certainly doing that to President Trump. The body language and the public response to this was stark. It was received pretty coldly by Democrats who have not had a good start with President Trump in the first 40 or so days. He has ridiculed Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader. He called the House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi incompetent. These are people he's going to need to work with, to woo and to cultivate in one way or another on key issues if he wants to get anything done. Because ultimately there's going to be disagreement or there's going to be a need for legislation to clear a hurdle in the Senate that requires at least a handful of Democratic votes. And outside of a handful of moderate Democrats who are up for re-election next year in states that Trump won, there's been very little cultivation of those Democrats. They sit here in Washington and see a guy who has, you know, upended American foreign policy, belittled or, in their view, disrespected the First Amendment, nominated a conservative to the Supreme Court that they fear could, you know, upend all sorts of domestic and legal policy in this country. And they're not pleased with him so far. The speech was a traditional presidential address. It was the most political speech, sort of traditional political speech that Trump had given. He showed the American people he's capable of rising to the big presidential moments. The question, I think, will be to what extent does he engage Congress in the coming weeks on revamping health care and the tax code and the nation's immigration policy? What, if anything, does he have to do to convince the Senate to quickly and easily confirm his Supreme Court nominee? And if he's able to get in there and twist arms the way guys like Lyndon Johnson did back in the day, that will be a better measure of his success.
And very shortly, isn't the Congress going to have to vote on raising the debt limit?
That comes in late April, and that comes right after, most likely, the Senate will have decided what to do with Neil Gorsuch, the Supreme Court nominee. So if that doesn't go well, attempts to deal with the debt limit, if that's when they have to do it, will be poisoned, essentially, by whatever goes on during the confirmation hearings. There are various so-called extraordinary measures that the government can take to extend it, if needed, into May, perhaps June and beyond, especially if they start to see a floating deadline a little further out in which they're going to try to get a lot of things done.
And,
but yes, that is one date on the calendar currently that is going to require a lot of action.
And what about the timeline on the White House budget proposal?
Well, we still haven't seen a specific proposal from them. Congress would certainly like to see it. The details that we saw come out in the last few days suggest a big increase for defense spending, slashes at places like the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department. All of that, in one way or another, for various members up here in both parties, is dead on arrival. I think we need to get away from calling these things the president's budget. If anything, they are the proposed budget, but really what they are is the president's political wish list. When he flashes his cards and shows everyone, in a perfect world, if I could do everything myself, this is what the government would look like, this is how we would spend our money. But remember, it has to go through Congress and the Appropriations Committee, and a lot of what has been proposed in the last few days is not going to survive. You heard people like the South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham say that the proposals to slash the State Department budget are dead on arrival, and that was buttressed by about 100 former top military leaders who signed a document saying that if you make those kinds of changes, you're actually going to make it much more difficult for the U.S. military to do its job around the world. So we'll see.
Now, what about infrastructure? Does all that just get put way down the line?
If you look at the speech the president gave, it certainly seems like it will, and he didn't even use the word infrastructure spending or the way it's being referred to up here on the Hill. Instead, he talked about national rebuilding, and it was one of the few moments I noticed during his speech in which members of both parties gladly, gleefully jumped to their feet to applaud. Democrats, I think, much more so than Republicans. Republicans understand that the nation needs new bridges and roads and airports and tunnels and seaports, but they don't want to broach the subject of figuring out how to pay for all of that amid all the other changes they're trying to make to health care, immigration, and the tax system. I suspect at this point that infrastructure spending is becoming a loftier goal that is further out and maybe the only thing he can turn to perhaps later in his presidency to try to build some bipartisan accord, but that will only come after the big three, health care, tax reform, immigration, are dealt with, and I don't suspect we'll see much movement on it this year. I could be wrong, but just, you know, given the priorities that the Congress has set for itself, dealing first with health care, which could take several months, and then tax reform, which would take the rest of the year, there's very little room there to talk about a major spending program.
You know, I get the impression, and please tell me if I'm wrong, that the president is now waffling on this issue of completely throwing out the Affordable Care Act. He has said is very complicated. He said perhaps we can amend it. What is your thinking?
Well, I think Republicans of all stripes, from the White House down here to the Capitol, have seen the polling that shows that Americans are very concerned about the possibility that the changes that they've dealt with in the last few years, many of which they enjoy, are going to be lost. And I think that's why it was important that the president there, when he laid out roughly the four bullet points that he had regarding health care reform, started with the idea that those with pre-existing conditions, once again, would not be discriminated
right.
against and would not lose coverage. That's
right.
top of mind for so many people across the country. And it's been those people or their spouses or their children who have come to town hall meetings and confronted especially Republican lawmakers to say, look, my dad or my cousin or my husband had cancer. He now has health care. What do you mean you're going to take that away from them? So they understand that. And that, I think, is what he's talking about. But what they really want to get at is the cost of it, the idea that somebody in Illinois can't buy a program that might be better served for their family in Indiana, and whether or not the states should or should not buy into or expand the Medicaid program. They're going to leave it up to them. And given that most of the country is run by Republican governors at this point, the thought is that Medicaid would be up for some more changes at the state-by-state level. So I think on Obamacare, on immigration, and on other issues, even foreign affairs, I mean, you saw him embrace NATO and sort of modify his language on that compared to what he said as a candidate. He's beginning to realize that these are complex issues, that campaigning in poetry is much easier than governing in prose,
absolutely.
As the late Mario Cuomo used to say.
And he's doubled down on his commitment to get rid of government regulations. What's happened so far? What do you see coming, especially when people like me, I'm old enough to recall the thalidomide disaster, the FDA has been there presumably to protect. Is there any way to actually tie cutting back regulations to changes in the job market?
Well, we'll see. We've seen some subtle and in some pockets significant changes already. He went after the Water of the United States policies that had been put in place by President Obama, which was seen as a big win for rural states like Idaho and others in the interior West. He has the Congress has very quickly made changes to some rules that require that the Social Security Administration inform those that run the gun background system about people who have mental illness. It was seen as restrictive. That's a win for the gun lobby and for those that don't like the red tape. You've seen them move on some other environmental issues to start to strip away the powers of the EPA. A lot of that's being done quietly or with less prominence than other top-of-mind issues, and it's being driven primarily by Republicans who sort of have a laundry list of things that they want to go after and a White House that's willing to do it in order to demonstrate progress and to keep Republicans happy. You saw him talk in the speech about the idea of making it easier at the FDA to move on some things and to drive down the prices or to allow for more innovation when it comes to medicine for rare diseases and whatnot. The FDA is obviously a big fat target, I think, for both parties these days, because there is concern about the speed at which some medicines are being approved and put on the market. And I suspect you'll see some more work on that. But there are the concerns that you address, and then there are the concerns about whether or not that agency is moving fast enough to bring some more life-saving products to the market. So a lot of that will go on. It's a less attractive, less sexy issue or subject to tackle, but it's the kind of thing that can get legislators really jazzed up because it will allow them to demonstrate some very specific wins for their state or for certain constituencies. And it's something the Republicans are eager to do because, like I said, you can then sit there at the White House and say, well, look at these dozen or so things we've already done and the other dozen that we're looking at.
Okay,
to roll things back.
What about jobs? Is there a connection between cutting back on those regulations and producing jobs?
Well, Republicans always claim to say that there is, but I don't think we're going to be able to measure that in any real way for a while. And even then, I think the way that is measured would probably be in dispute. You know, the one big one that they believe has been a job killer, and you hear Republicans say, you know, almost hourly, is the current health care system. They believe that it's causing employers, especially smaller employers, to cut back job hours or to not hire more people. If they make changes in the coming few years, then we're going to have to wait a few more years after that, probably into what would be conceivably a second Trump term, to see whether or not job creation has been spurred by changing the healthcare law or making other changes. The other ones to measure that I think we may get an easier measure on sooner just because they can be done so much more quickly are the environmental rollbacks. Will we see some evidence of farm growth or other manufacturing growth because certain changes are made to environmental policy? Again, hard to track and it takes a few years, but Republicans have always been convinced that there will be job growth if they do these changes.
The president proposed setting up a new office in the Department of Homeland Security to serve victims of crime committed by undocumented immigrants. What are the facts on crime in this country, and what percentage can actually be attributed to immigrants?
Well, I don't have those facts in front of me, Diane, but we know this. It's not as widespread as the president and some Republicans would often lead you to believe. And that was one of the moments in his speech, I think, that really got under the craw of people who are eager to do bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform, because they say, look, the vast majority of immigrants who come to this country, legally or illegally, are here to better their lives, to take advantage of economic opportunity, and to give back to their families who are either with them here in the United States or back in their home country, and to focus intently on these awful cases where an undocumented immigrant committed a crime and killed somebody or did something else to an American, they feel is not necessarily helpful. It's an issue. It is one that they're trying to deal with. And there's universal agreement up here at the Capitol that those who have committed crimes or repeat illegal immigrant offenders need to be removed from the country and sent to their home countries. But the idea that you have to create an office for a group of individuals who may have been the victims of crimes committed by immigrants was one that left some people, I think, up here scratching their heads, because they said this isn't necessarily as widespread an issue as you might believe. Certainly it's captured the attention of certain media outlets, and it captured the president's attention when he was a candidate. We remember his talk about that woman from San Francisco almost constantly, and in the fact that her family even stepped in and said, please, back off. You know, this was an isolated incident, but we don't want to become a poster child for this. I almost immediately was hearkening on the fact that very quickly there were a lot of people who said, you know, this is not the biggest issue of concern when it comes to immigration. The bigger issue is these people are coming or they're staying longer than they're supposed to. We need to get on to that. And just like any other group of people, crimes are committed, and all crime, no matter who commits it, has to be dealt with.
Indeed. David Ignatius in the Washington Post recently argued that President Trump campaigned on the argument that trade has been the major cause of job losses, an argument that he and an awful lot of other people say is false. What do you know about that?
Well, I think that there are members of both parties who believe that the way that the trade systems have been set up in recent years has been detrimental. And I think most of those lawmakers or Democrats and Republicans come from the Midwestern or the Rust Belt states that have been adversely affected by the downturn in manufacturing. But, you know, there are others who say, look, just the way of the world and innovation these days is such that a lot of those jobs aren't necessarily going to return if NAFTA or the TPP is ripped up and rethought. And so, you know, it's a popular issue for him, and it's one on which he easily divides or at least complicates things for Democrats because, of course, people will remember that last year during the presidential campaign, it wasn't just Donald Trump who was concerned about global trade agreements. It was also Bernie Sanders
sure.
and many other
sure.
Democrats who have said that these programs are unfair to the American worker or to workers' rights around the world. And
but doesn't that give supporters of the president a kind of false hope that jobs are going to come back when, in fact, they've been replaced by machines?
Well, yeah, I mean, it might. And certainly there are those like yourself who make that argument and make it pretty regularly. And I think that's the real test of this president, Diane, really will start to come, I think, by the fall. If his supporters especially, but Americans overall, aren't necessarily feeling a change in their own economic status because of what has or has not been done by Washington, will it start to adversely affect his standing with Republicans and his supporters overall? The stock market's going gangbusters, but most Americans don't necessarily feel the effects of
right,
that.
Right.
It's just one almost superficial economic indicator. What will matter more is, you know, does take-home pay increase? Do the jobs get created that people want, or do they return? The president can seize on auto manufacturers and other manufacturing firms in the Midwest and the states he won, deciding not to take jobs to Mexico or China or bringing back some jobs. But they're not bringing all of them back, and they're not saving all of them. Even that case with Carrier in Indiana, you know, they decided to preserve some of the jobs in that location, but not all of them, and some are still headed to Mexico. So it will be interesting in the coming years, I think, to see him explain that if things don't necessarily turn around.
All right. And Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post, I'm going to ask you the same question I put to Maggie Haberman of the New York Times. The claims against, well, the claims by the White House and his spokespeople about fake news, alternative facts. How are you, as a reporter, dealing with those issues? How is the Washington Post responding?
I would point you to the comments of our executive editor, my boss, Marty Baron, who at a conference out on the West Coast a few days ago said, look, we're not at war with the administration. We're merely doing our jobs, and we will continue to do so.
At the same time, President Trump has called the news media the enemy of the American people.
Yeah, well, we have a First Amendment, and he's exercising his right to use it, and so are we. And we will continue to do that. And we would do that whether he's the president or Hillary Clinton is the president. Look, there's always been adversarial relationships between a president and the press. We haven't seen anything quite like this ever before. People call this Nixonian in some respects. I would argue it's different than Nixonian because the president never, President Nixon never really said anything quite like President Trump has said in recent days. But look, we are continuing to do our job, and I have said since after the election that I think this will be journalism's finest hour. There were people who were so concerned about, you know, are you going to be safe? Are you going to be able to do your jobs? I think we've been able to do a heck of a job, Diane, because we are publishing every hour of the day, every minute of the day, and people are coming to us with information. They trust us to disseminate it and to share it. And if that means that people are putting their jobs within the government at risk or feel the need to speak out despite collecting a government paycheck, that is their decision. And we are here to review that information, disseminate it, and report it if it's appropriate to do so. And we will continue to do that.
Are you doing your job more carefully, would you say?
I think we're always, in the modern age, even before the 2016 campaign began, attuned to making sure that our reporting is accurate and fair because the ways of social media and the echo chambers that it creates can very quickly allow criticism or mistakes to get pointed out and to go viral. So we've always in recent history been sensitive to that. But I wouldn't say that just because Donald Trump was elected, suddenly, you know, another set of eyes is looking at everything. We were doing that anyway. We should be doing that every day on everything we write.
You bet. Thank you, Ed. Good to talk with you.
Anytime, Diane. Great to speak with you.
Okay. Bye-bye. We heard Maggie Haberman talk about President Trump's reaction to recent anti-Semitic attacks. So for our From the Archive segment this week, I wanted to hear from a 2015 interview with former Anti-Defamation League National Director Abraham Foxman. We spoke just before he stepped down.
Anti-Semitism, I wish it was a fact of history. It isn't. It is today at a higher level than it's been since World War II.
How do you account for that?
Well, because we've never, Diane, we've never really developed a vaccine. We've never developed an antidote. And the only antidote we have is education. The trouble is you can be infected much quicker. You know, you can be taught to hate much quicker than you're taught to unhate. It's a much more difficult process. The internet has a lot to do with it. The internet, which has already destroyed privacy, is destroying civility. And when people stop talking to each other, they respect each other less. And so today, hatred, bigotry, prejudice, racism, anti-Semitism can travel in nanoseconds around the globe. It never dies. It's like a tsunami out there. And it gives it a certain credibility, a certain legitimacy, which it never had before. And so that accounts for some of it. But basically, Diane, we never really, you know, after Auschwitz, one would have thought that the world scientists, engineers, philosophers would all come together to develop an antidote. They developed the UN. Well, you know what? The UN is only a reflection of the reality, nothing more than that. But we didn't develop that vaccine, so it's still there.
And you can hear that entire interview at dianereem.org. That's what was on my mind this week. As always, you can let us know what's on your mind. Find us at Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or leave a voice memo at 202-854-8851. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show was produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next week.